My name's Andy Whiteman. I'm a writer and researcher. I am self-employed. I live in Edinburgh. And I'm here to talk about land, society and economy, the importance of land, not just as an economic resource, but also in terms of how it fits in with our sense of place and the kind of impact that how we regulate land, its ownership, its use, etc., has on places and on people. It's a story that ranges from the financial crash to the hills of the Highlands. Thanks very much, Brian. I actually forgot what the title of this talk was, which is why I never stuck it on the slide. Many thanks for the invitation and delighted to see so many of you here. I'm just wearing my reading glasses because I want to see my computer, so you're all just a bit of a haze, actually. One day I'll be able to afford these posh glasses that you can look two directions at once. Land is a big topic, and what I want to do over the next 40 minutes really is just to explore some aspects of how broad and deep this is, ranging over issues to do with the economy, with health and well-being, cultural values, democracy, etc. And I want us to start by talking about why it's important in a range of ways. I then want to move on to say how we got to where we are today. And then I want to talk about issues that are around today, including things like housing, finance, democracy, and conclude by just a little sort of indication about where we might be going. Now, I left school and I went to work as a tree planter in Aberfeldy in Perthshire. I got quite interested in what I was doing there. We were cutting down the birks of Aberfeldy and piling them up and putting a tyre on top, lighting it with diesel and burning it and ploughing it. And it was all very sort of destructive. By the way, I tend to talk forever. Has one of you got a watch I can put here? Because I've switched my phone off because it'll run out of battery. Right, that's grand. It's an elegant little watch. So I got interested in the subject of forestry, and I went to Aberdeen University to study the topic. And when I was there, the debacle over the Flow Country kicked off. For those of you who don't remember that or were not around at the time, this was an area illustrated here of very deep peatlands in Caithness and Sutherland in the north of Scotland. And accountants had found a way of running a tax avoidance scheme, essentially, which allowed people with a lot of money to buy land here, plant trees, and then they would switch from Schedule B to Schedule D taxation or whatever. And they could make a lot of money out of this. And this is what was happening. Now, as this was people like Hurricane Higgins and Terry Wogan, and they weren't called celebrities in those days, but, you know, they would be celebrities today. And so they were buying areas of land and planting it with trees. Now, people like the RSPB and the Nature Conservancy Council at the time were very annoyed about this because this was valuable habitat for divers and various birds. This is an amazing environment, very, very deep peatlands. I questioned whether it was a very sensible idea to plant trees on deep peat. I was told not to be silly, but of course now the National Heritage Lottery Fund is paying vast sums of money to get rid of all these trees because they haven't grown, so I was proven right on that one. Anyway, one thing that did intrigue me was, you know, why we were doing this in the first place. And so when the chief executive of the company that was responsible for most of this came and gave us a lecture, I asked at the end a naive question. I said, why is the government giving millions of pounds in tax breaks to wealthy people in London, mainly, to plant trees 500 miles away? Why doesn't it just give that same amount of money that it's foregoing in tax revenues as a grant to the landowners and the farmers and the crofters who live here and they could plant them? And as I say, it was a naive question. I just didn't understand why, if this was how you went about planting trees, you would want to do it this way. But I don't remember the answer, but certainly afterwards my professor pulled me to one side and said he didn't think it was a very smart move to ask politically sensitive questions. And I didn't know what was politically sensitive about this, but I quickly realized that I thought I was at university to learn and ask questions, and I was being told that you shouldn't ask certain questions, so that just encouraged me to ask more questions. And I suddenly realized when you talk about land and power and money, some people feel uncomfortable, and I really enjoyed that feeling, so I've kept doing it. And those of you who sort of follow my blog will see a story on the Parliament House in Edinburgh, which I broke yesterday, which is I think Europe's oldest purpose-built parliament building in an ancient capital and an ancient nation, which has been under the stewardship of the city of Edinburgh since 1640, when we the people by public subscription and through the Common Good Fund, built it for the Parliament, and they inadvertently gave it away 6 years ago. Without someone just phoned them up saying, "Is it yours?" and they said no. So one of my themes in my talk is going to be kind of democracy and transparency and vigilance. So anyway, it's not often acknowledged that land played a central role in the financial crash that we experienced back in 2007-2008. In the United States of America, people were selling subprime mortgages, lending money to poor people to buy houses. Now, they knew that these poor people, generally speaking, could not afford to pay the money back. But they gave them what were called teaser rates of interest, often 0%. And when they asked, well, what happens in 2 years' time when the interest rates go up? They were told not to worry, because if they bought a house today at $200,000, it'd be worth $250,000 in 2 years. And if they really were struggling, they could just sell it and it'd be all right. Of course, that never happened. I mean, people didn't pay them off. And of course, then these mortgages were securitized as financial products and sold around the world. And when people began defaulting on their mortgages, nobody really knew who they owed the mortgage to. These were all around the world on balance sheets of banks. The whole interbank lending thing froze up, and that was the trigger for the global financial crash. So land and how you steward it and what you do with it and how you regulate things like lending are quite important. Now, when Gordon Brown came to power in 1997 in his first budget, he said, "I will not allow house prices to get out of control." I appreciated this statement because I'd bought a house during the boom in 1991, I think it was, and I lost a lot of money. I've never owned a house since as a result. But 10 years later, when Gordon Brown left as Chancellor and became Prime Minister, house prices had trebled. Our current Chancellor, George Osborne, went to Dublin in February 2006 to give a lecture at Trinity College Dublin and said that Ireland stands as a shining example of the art of the possible in long-term economic policymaking. Every 23rd of February, I think it is. Yes, so that's next week. I make a great song and dance about this speech and publish it on my blog, because it does illustrate the fact that people who one would think might know better have been completely deluded by the role that property has played in the economic crisis that hit Ireland. And our own dear recent leader also talked about lessons to draw from Ireland, where annual growth has averaged more than 6%. With the right strategy, there are no limits to success in the global economy. To his credit, he didn't actually say that the Irish had the right strategy, but I think he thought they had. And of course, in Ireland, the banks all went bust. This is Sean Fitzpatrick, the chief executive of Anglo-Irish Bank, who was arrested. And the Financial Times described it, David Gardner, at the height of the lunacy, around three quarters of the total lending by Irish banks, 420 billion, or about 2.5 times the size of the Irish economy, got bound up in property, construction and land speculation of one sort or another, a sort of Northern Rock on steroids. And again, a failure to properly regulate the relationship between money and land brought down the Irish economy, and they're still paying the price. Land is also an important factor in growing inequality, not only in Britain here, but around the world. Thomas Piketty has highlighted this in his great book recently, and Oxfam also, in the report they did for the Davos World Summit, highlighted we need to shift from, I think, number three of their seven policy suggestions to reduce inequality, was to move taxes from incomes and consumption onto wealth and assets. One of the reasons we've got ourselves in a bit of a sticky position is because since the 1970s, exchange controls, Big Bang, and a variety of other reforms that took place mainly in the early years of the Thatcher government, and the deregulation of building societies, etc. Banks, and it's not often understood this, but banks essentially make their own money. When you go and apply for a loan to a bank, they just type it on the computer. They have to then settle their balance sheet overnight in the London Exchange, which is the London overnight borrowing rate, the LIBOR, which we've heard about. So banks that have lent a lot of money during the day will settle with banks who've taken in a lot during the day. But the bottom line is this money, or 97% of the money in the economy, is magicked out of thin air by private banks. And over the last 30 years, increasing amounts of this money has been devoted to lending for domestic property. In other words, that's trillions of pounds that's been created to lend on an essentially unproductive asset, completely unproductive asset. House doesn't create any wealth whatsoever. It's a, and so you look at a graph like this that shows the money supply, the broad money supply, M4, and house prices, and it's no coincidence that they roughly track each other. Now, banking in a country like Germany is very, very different. So, for example, 43% of banking in Germany is done by local government-owned banks. So it's like Glasgow City Council Bank, Sparkassen. 27% local cooperative banks. In other words, 70% of the banking sector in Germany is controlled, is accounted for by hundreds of locally controlled small banks, which people own. And historically, the Germans have not sunk money, private debt, into housing. They've put money into industry to create jobs. And Britain is heading for £1.5 trillion of private debt, mostly secured against housing, which is money that is sitting on our shoulders collectively to be paid off over the years and not available for productive investment. And one of the things that exacerbates that whole crisis is the fact that, at least in the United States when they had the crash, people could, had they bought a house and they couldn't afford the mortgage, they could actually literally just take the keys and hand them into the bank and walk off, and they were free to start again. Those are so-called non-recourse loans. In other words, the bank cannot chase you for the money it's lent you. What it has is the asset secured against it. And if that asset has halved in value, well, tough luck, the bank's risk. Whereas in Britain, if we have a crash, and we will have a crash, because although wages are slowly rising, they basically have been flatlining for a long time, interest rates are going to go up, housing is about three times more expensive than it should be, and people are not going to be able to afford to pay for it. We have recourse loans, and Scotland's the worst in Britain. So you take a loan of £100,000, your house crashes in value by half, you lose your job, you can get chased for 20 years for not only the principal, but the interest. And again, that's crazy because it's dumping all the risk on the shoulders of citizens. So how we kind of manage what I call this kind of archaeology of land, the stuff that's kind of beneath the surface that people don't really kind of think about, is actually very critical. Now, I just want to kind of do two examples about why land matters. And the first relates to this place. Does anyone know where this is? It's a sizable crowd. Someone should. Okay, this is the Linwood car plant in Linwood, where they made the Hillman Imp. And when Roots, who were the company, came here in the 60s, of course, it led to a big demand for employment. And so the local, the small village that was there called Linwood expanded quite considerably. And the district council at the time, I can't remember what it was called, probably Renfrew County Council, granted a 165-year lease on the town centre of Linwood on which to build a shopping centre, a regional shopping centre, which was quite novel in those days. Apparently, I don't know much about retail stuff, but apparently it was quite novel. Anyway, by 2000, this shopping centre had gone into decline. Linwood was awarded the Pluck on the Plinth by, who awards that? Urban Realm. But more significant than that, all the shopkeepers were leaving. And the reason they were leaving was because the rents for the shops were being driven up to the extent they couldn't afford to pay them. So they all went out of business. And local people began questioning, why is this happening? They started looking at the landlord of the shopping centre, which was a company called Balmore Properties Limited, and why was it doing this? And why was it destroying their town centre? And they couldn't find out because Balmore was one of these companies that had about two directors in Glasgow and they wouldn't speak, and it was very difficult. Wendy Alexander was the MSP at the time. From 2001, she said Balmore's stewardship was a disgrace. Following on from years of neglect, Balmore repeatedly refused to meet community or elected representatives. And then Tesco stepped in. And Tesco said, we'll take over the shopping centre and we'll build a superstore and a chemist. And I gather Tesco in places now has post offices in it. I mean, the things that used to be kind of part of our civic apparatus are now inside private superstores. But anyway, they came to the rescue. And people started again questioning Balmore. Wendy Alexander said in 2005 and 6, when I and many in the community were actively looking for a major retailer to step in, the Tesco representatives gave no indication to the community of any long-standing relationship with Balmore. They should have done so. And the reason they should have done so was because Balmore had been set up by Tesco as a front company with the express aim of driving all the tenants out of the shopping centre so that Tesco could then come in and say, hey, we'll take it over. So as the local councillor said, Tesco came in like a knight in shining armour and said they were going to fix it. It was all a con. Tesco said it's common for Tesco to use an agent and secure land. Balmore Properties was an agent for Tesco at that time. And so Lynwood now literally is Tesco Town. I'm not sure actually if it's on the list of closure. But what that highlights is a community which has been through a lot historically in terms of economic booms and busts. And here it was in the modern era, 10 years ago, completely out of control over a major aspect to do with land in its community because of a lack of transparency, essentially a lack of transparency. Another example I just want to use is completely different and goes back to my time in Aberdeen. I was fortunate when I was in Aberdeen to meet and get to know an ecologist called Adam Watson, who some of you might know, he's got a big white beard. He's now 87 or so, he's not out so much. But he took me to meet this woman on the top right, and her name was Jean Bain. And she lived in this farm called Ardoch on the top left there, which, for those of you who are familiar with that part of the world, will recognise Loch na Garr in the background. So, splendid spot for a small farm. And Jean was the tenant farmer there, and her family had been living there forever. Jean died in 1992. And the interesting thing about Jean, and that's her son in the bottom right, and you know who's with her son. Selena Scott, yes. I mean, we know our celebrities, don't we? We don't know our redundant car plants. Now, Jean was interesting because Jean was the last native speaker of Deeside Gaelic. Deeside Gaelic was a very interesting dialect of Gaelic. It was very, very distinctive because people didn't tend to travel across the Cairngorms much, and also because it was infused with Doric and Scandinavian influences as well up the Dee. She was the last native speaker. And she died in 1992, and with her died Deeside Gaelic. And the reason she was the last native speaker of Deeside Gaelic is because in 1886, when the Crofting Acts were passed, there was a big debate as to whether the Crofting Act should apply to the whole of Scotland and give small farmers security of tenure, or whether to restrict it. Most progressive opinion was of the view that it should extend over the whole of Scotland. The lowland landowners, including the royal family and people, were very resistant to this and didn't want security being given to their tenants. So they concocted a reason as to why it should be restricted to the current seven crofting counties in the Highlands, which was that it would only apply to those counties that had been visited and taken and evidence taken by the Napier Commission, which was a commission of inquiry set up to look into the plight of small farmers. Now, actually, their first evidence session was in Edinburgh, but Midlothian wasn't included. But all of their other evidence sessions were in the Ross and Cromarty, Sutherland, Invernessshire, Argyll, Orkney, Shetland, and they were not in Aberdeenshire. So when the Crofting Act came in Aberdeenshire, the crofters in Aberdeenshire got no security of tenure, and as a result, they slowly all disappeared. And Jean was the last indigenous, if you like, Gaelic person, and now there's nobody who owns their own property in Upper Deeside. Her son didn't speak any Gaelic. He died in 2004, and then her farm was put on the international property market. So land matters in terms of the, you know, the curation of our culture. It's central to that. Now, just briefly, kind of how we got here. I kind of run through this in my book, what I call the kind of six land grabs. But feudalism was critical to all of this. People like Bruce, who fought for the crown of Scotland, secured the crown, and by securing the crown, essentially secured ownership of the whole country. The crown owns the whole country, except that which is feud out. And of course, Bruce could then give grants, charters, royal charters to his friends, the nobility, and also to the early royal boroughs of Scotland. So that was the first land grab. There were indigenous forms of tenure before that. The second sort of land grab I talk about is in the 16th century during the Reformation, which came late in Scotland in 1560, but it's not been much studied. And that's where essentially the nobility got their sons and nephews into the abbeys of the old church as what were called commendators, kind of chief executives or financial officers. And they looked after the financial and legal affairs of these large ecclesiastical estates. This is Crossraigle Abbey in Mabel, which owned virtually all of Ayrshire at the time. And these commendators then proceeded to grant to their noble friends in life rent large areas of land. And these life rents, rent for your life, were then converted to fews in Parliament. So there's a very slow, insidious process of appropriation of the church's wealth, such that when Knox secured the Reformation in one sitting of Parliament in 1560 and opened the books, it was rather like the coalition government. I think one minister turned up in a department and there was a sticky note on the desk saying, the money's run out. Knox opened the books and found there was no money. The land had all been fewed. And his great dream of taking this enormous wealth, which was bigger than the wealth of the crown at the time, this enormous wealth and devoting a third of it to a school in every parish, a third of it to the administration of the country, and a third of it to the church's administration was dashed. The 17th century was the third land grab, where the Scottish Parliament spent most of its time passing laws to buttress the power of property, starting with the 1617 Registration Act, the Register of Seizings. Those of you who own property may well have your property registered in that register. And that was a very early and neat device. It basically allowed you to submit a deed for recording into the register. It was made public to the extent that anyone ever went to Edinburgh and could read Latin, but it was publicly available for those who wished to see it. And then the Act passed the Act of Prescription, which basically meant that even if you had a dodgy deed and you didn't really own the land and stole it from the church or whatever, as long as you could sit on it for 40 years, it would then become immune from challenge. And that's the Act of Prescription, which still applies today. The period is now 10 years. They passed things like the Law of Entail, which allowed the nobility to entail their estates and basically freeze the assets so that creditors couldn't get hold of them. So the normal economic cycle where people would go bust and the creditors would seize their assets and resell them never happened to Scottish land. And the Law of Entail was only finally abolished in 2000 under the Feudal Abolition Act. So a lot of the 17th century was spent in the Scottish Parliament passing laws to protect the interests of landowners and also devising new ways of killing Highlanders as well was a popular pastime of the era. Then the fourth land grab occurred following the final act in the 17th century, the 1695 Commonty Division Act. In Scotland's parishes, there were extensive areas of common land called commonties, which a leading legal scholar, Rankin, describes as a state of possession already subsisting beyond the memory of man. In other words, these were areas of common land that predate feudalism and predate even possibly the founding of a modern state called Scotland. But the 1695 Act was passed and it's still on the statute book today. I tried to get the government to repeal it, but they refused. And that allowed one heritor in the parish, one landowner, to go to the court and start proceedings for division. And the proceedings of division were very simple. You would perambulate, a surveyor would perambulate the common, divide it up amongst all the heritors in the parish. And so the poor people in the parish lost their access to very valuable bits of land for bleaching, for gathering fuel and divots and sectarian preaching and illicit affairs and illicit whiskey and all sorts of stuff. So they were rapidly divided up. And it contrasts with the situation in England, where the Acts of Enclosure, which were a similar economic process, had to be passed act by act. So every common had its own act. So there were thousands of Acts of Enclosure. That took a lot of time in Parliament. It was quite complex. And so a lot remains in England today. 750,000 acres of common land remains, compared to Scotland, where virtually none does. The Commonties Division Act of 1695 excluded the royal boroughs. Land was deemed to be far too valuable in these areas to divide up. But the problem with Scotland's royal boroughs was that in the 15th century, we actually had primitive elections. So the burgesses had a vote on an annual basis to elect the council. The problem was that in a number of boroughs, these elections stopped being held. And there were actually protests and riots in the street to demand that the elections be held, even by people who didn't have the vote themselves. And so Parliament, instead of passing an act to insist upon these annual elections and possibly even extend the franchise, actually passed the Officers of Boroughs Act, which said, let's abolish elections and the town council shall be elected by the old town council. So the old town council shall choose the next one. And together they will sit down and appoint the officers of the borough, the staff. And that state of affairs persisted till 1833, Borough Reform Act. So Scotland was run for 350 years through a process of rampant nepotism and corruption, which is well documented by a commission of inquiry into municipal corporations in 1832, where the commissioners go around Scotland speaking to the officers and councillors and boroughs and turn up in places like Fortrose and discover that the treasurer has run away and nobody knows where he's gone. And they come back a week later and he's still away and apparently he's at his aunt's in Glasgow. And where are the accounts? Well, he has the accounts, no one else has the accounts. So they come back a month later, eventually he comes back and they look at these accounts. And so who else sees these accounts? Well, just him and the provost. And when were these accounts drawn up? It turns out they were drawn up the day before the commissioner's visit. So there was rampant nepotism and corruption, and that meant a lot of common land in Scotland's boroughs disappeared. Now, of course, that is all part of the kind of history of the common riding festivals, principally in the borders today, which have a long history of people going out on horseback and riding around the marches of the town's lands to ensure that there was no encroachment taking place, because the Dukes of Roxburgh and the Marquess of Lothian and people were very keen to encroach on land within a royal borough, because it made you a vassal of the crown, you had a vote, and it was also economically incredibly valuable. So there was a policing function that had to be done by the people of the town, which is what these were about. And places like Aberdeen, Bruce granted Aberdeen the so-called Freedom Lands, 14 miles in circumference around Aberdeen, huge extent of land granted to the people of Aberdeen. This is one of the March Stones, there are 75 of these. All that land virtually went through rampant municipal nepotism and corruption, and had to be bought back by later town councils to build the west end of Aberdeen and Hazelhead Park and places. Towns like St Andrews, their maladministration was to such an extent they went bankrupt, 1796, I think. And their incredibly valuable common lands were, of course, the links, the golf links, the Pilmuir links, as they were called then. And in order to generate some money, the town council leased this out to a rabbit farmer called Mr Dempster. And to begin with, the townspeople were quite happy. They, of course, still had the right to play golf on it, as they had all the time. But the rabbits, of course, multiplied, and nine-hole courses turned to 50-hole courses, and new bunkers appeared. And there began a phase of 2 or 3 years of the rabbit wars, when literally the blood was spilt and the wardens would be attacked. This went all the way to the House of Lords, and eventually there was a settlement. But so these dramas were being played out all across Scotland's towns in the 19th century. In Eyemouth, the fisherwomen of Eyemouth went all the way to the court of session to defend their right to bleach on the town's green, etc. So land was central to people's lives, and ordinary people had the right in law to sue the town council and to sue landowners to protect their common rights, and they did so with some gusto. The sixth land grab, as we sort of ran out of land here, we went overseas and stole other people's countries. And that was a very, very simple process. I mean, Captain Cook was, can't remember, he's not there. Captain Cook was actually in public, he was sent off on a scientific expedition to observe the transit of Venus from Tahiti. That's why he sailed off. But he also had secret instructions from the Admiralty, which were basically to colonize any land that hadn't been colonized by somebody else. So when he landed in Queensland and nobody else was there, except there were local people there, obviously, but not white people. He just planted a flag and read a declaration and proclaimed it in the name of Her Majesty, and that bit of Australia became British. Africa, the Berlin Conference of 1873, as I recall, attended by most of the great powers in Europe. They carved up Africa amongst themselves. There wasn't a single African at the conference. Of all the diplomats, only one person had ever visited Africa. But this was the great scramble for Africa, the great scramble for the colonies. And but, you know, this all comes round and bites you. So back in the 1980s, this man on the left here called Eddie Mabo, who was a Torres Strait Islander, had a job in James Cook University in Townsville in northern Queensland, and he was very popular around the university. He was a very learned man. And he was sitting, he would have lunch with academics and people. And he was sitting having lunch today with a couple of historians. And he happened to talk about his land that he owned back on Mer, which was the island from the Torres Straits he lived in. And these two historians tried to break it to him gently that this wasn't his land, that all land was crown land in Australia. And actually their rights had been extinguished following British colonization. He was quite shocked at this. Denied that this was the case, and eventually sued the state of Queensland when they tried to take a bit of his land, or the land of his people, rather. Sued them, and eventually went all the way through to the High Court of Australia and won in a very, very famous judgment, Mabo versus Queensland, that admitted that for the first time in Australian history that the land of Australia, when the British arrived, was not terra nullius, that there were people there, that those people had rights, and turned a sort of legal fiction that had persisted for 200 years completely on its head. And so the court ruled that land in the Murray Islands is not Crown land, and that the Meriam people are entitled against the whole world to possession, occupation, use and enjoyment. This sent shockwaves through Australian society. It energised the Aboriginal community to such an extent that I think it was the 1994 Commonwealth Games in Victoria, in Canada. Cathy Freeman, was a great athlete, the first Aboriginal athlete in the Australian team, paraded her victory lap with the Aboriginal flag, which caused massive consternation because you're not allowed to do this, divided Australian society. And during the 90s, Australia had a big battle with itself about who they were and all the rest of it. And it's all been, has not been resolved, but it was an important moment in terms of recovering a sense of who was who and whose land it was. The last act of imperial possession, imperial land grabbing, actually took place just off the shore of Scotland. And this was in Rockall, out in the North Atlantic. And in the post-war period, during the Cold War, Britain was very concerned that Rockall would become perhaps a site for the Soviets to put a little listening station on, because we were launching rockets from South US, testing rockets. So the Soviets could easily put a little station there and track our rockets and stuff. So Britain thought, well, we need to claim this. And so the Admiralty approached the Colonial Office. They still had a Colonial Office in 1955, and said, how do you colonize? And they said, well, we're actually trying to get rid of our colonies. And they said, yeah, but we want this bit of rock. And they said, well, it's very easy. You just get a royal warrant and you go and proclaim it. So they got a royal warrant from the Queen, and they sailed off in HMS Vidal, and Captain O'Connell landed. The captain didn't land. Three people landed, hoisted the Union flag, read this proclamation, declared the land to be part of the United Kingdom, and the ship sailed past. There was a 21-gun salute, and puffins and guillemots were bemused, and Rockall was British. That's the plaque. By authority of Her Majesty, etc., her realms and territories, queens and defenders and faiths and things, in accordance with her instructions, the land that was affected this day. The Union flag was hoisted and possession of the island was taken in of Her Majesty. They couldn't land on the 18th of September because it was too rough, the sea was too rough. So that was the engraving. So they had to change it to the 19th of September. Otherwise, there might have been a legal case taken against them. It didn't really affect a landing on the 18th, it was the 19th. Anyway, coming to the kind of modern era, as it were, and some kind of issues, you know, contemporarily that are important and why this is all relevant. I just want to sort of put this into your mind, because land reform is popularly thought of as a kind of process that takes place in Venezuela and Thailand and Zimbabwe and places, where it is essentially a redistributive process, redistributing land to landless peasants. But actually, land reform is much, much wider than that. And it was defined by the Land Reform Review Group in 2014 as measures that modify or change the arrangements governing the possession and use of land in Scotland in the public interest. So anything that changes the relationship between society and any piece of land, this piece of land I'm standing on now, Rockall, wherever, is technically land reform. I just want to talk about one important example, which is housing. It's one of the big political issues in Britain at the moment. And what the Land Reform Review Group helpfully inform us as well in this table, figure 19, is that back in 1930, a building worker on building workers' wages could buy an average house for £590, which is a 3.5 ratio of house price to earnings. Now that ratio is 7.5. It's become virtually unaffordable. The other important thing to note about the ratio back in 1930 was that only about 5% of that price was paid for the land. 95% paid for the building itself. So 90% of what anyone had available employed builders, labor, and acquired materials to build the house. And as a consequence, they built very high quality houses in the 1930s, many of which are still standing, and many of which will long outlive houses that are built today. Where today, typically 40, 50, even 60, in some cases 70% of the cost of a house is the land. So people have much less, I mean, it's much more expensive, but they've also got much less to devote to the actual building of the house, which is why new housing in Britain is dominated by volume house builders, and it's got the smallest rooms in Britain, it's most densely packed, and it's frankly crap. This looks at housing costs over the last 30 years, from 1983 to 2007. showing along the bottom there earnings and building costs over that period, which are basically flatlined. They haven't increased. What has increased is land prices at the top, and that's what's made housing more expensive. It's also the key to our volume house building model, where 80-85% of housing is built by these volume house builders who make all the profit from the land, because land that's worth £12,000 a hectare for agriculture is then worth 12 million or 1.2 million or 5 million a hectare for housing. In fact, I was in the Highlands in a hunting lodge a number of years ago, and I was going through the wicker basket to get copies of the Daily Telegraph to light the fire. And I found copies of the board papers of a prominent volume house builder. Clearly, their executives had been there on a fishing trip in the summer. Literally a fishing trip, I mean, just as a wee trip. Anyway, one of them had obviously brought their board papers with them. I mean, they may even have had a board meeting there, I don't know. But there was 10 of these papers. And I looked at them, they were fascinating. They're about, you know, shall we buy 2 acres of land in Renfrewshire to build some houses and whatever. And at the back was a fascinating calculation showing how they calculated how profitable this might be. And that was all related to, obviously, the cost of services, how close it was to water and drainage and all the rest of it, what the soil conditions were like, what access was like, how many roads they need to build and all the rest of it. That, across the piece, was basically a standard cost, though. They wouldn't look at places that were really, really difficult. And then there was the cost of building. And then I recall, I have a huge archive of stuff at home in a cellar, and for the life of me, I can't find these papers, but I do recall at the time noting that in 6 or 7 out of 10 cases, they actually lost money building the house. Building the house was a kind of necessary inconvenience after they'd bought the land. And of course, the people who would buy these houses were not known. There was no client relationship. There's no customer relationship here. It's just get them up and there'll be a market for them. And this contrasts hugely with the market in France, in Belgium, in Germany, where anything from 40, 50, 60, 70, even 80% of the housing market is self-built. So people buy a plot for 20,000 euros from the local municipality in Belgium or Germany. They then employ one of thousands of building companies to build a very high quality house with 80, 90% of their funds are available to actually spend in the productive economy, with plenty of competition of builders willing to build you, wanting to build you the best house, the biggest house, the house that will last forever, and the house that will be really, really cheap to run, which is why your typical house in Germany is far, far superior to housing in Britain. But in Britain, we have, in Scotland, we have companies like Hebridean Homes, who can build you this nice little three-bedroomed house for £85,000. And it's built to very high standards. And my understanding is this is built to Danish housing building standards. Beautiful little houses, built as a kit, erected in 7 days. Now, £80,000 is kind of 3.5 times your average earnings. So a building worker actually could afford this. The problem is they need to get the land to put it on, and that's the killer. And this isn't helped by the fact that the tax relationship, the fiscal relationship of land, is totally skewed. This is an extract from a National Audit Office report called Tax Reliefs, which was published earlier last year. George Osborne was furious at the National Audit Office for publishing a report called Tax Reliefs, because his view was the National Audit Office was there to audit public expenditure. The National Audit Office took the view that tax reliefs were a form of public expenditure, because this is revenue we're forgoing. Anyway, there's a huge tussle between the Treasury and the Comptroller General of Audit, who took legal advice and eventually backtracked, and their next report was called The Administration of Tax Reliefs. In other words, we can look at HMRC and how it administers them, but we can't question the validity, legitimacy, and value of them in the first place. Fortunately, they'd already done their first report. And so in this report, you see that the biggest tax relief is the personal allowance on income tax, which is not unsurprising. Which is not surprising. But the 10th one, sort of light one in the middle, is exemption on gains of disposable of main residence. So in other words, when you sell a house, you pay no capital gains tax. All this does is push house prices up. All sorts of things push house prices up. Things like how you bid. So if all of us, if there's a house here and all of us put in a bid, and I'm the owner and I'm selling, and someone offers me £200,000 for it, and the next person offers £190,000. I'll go for the £200,000. But I didn't need that. All I needed was £190,000 and one pence. So we don't auction houses, so nobody knows what anyone else is paying. So there's a built-in, incremental, unnecessary increase in house prices all the time. So there's many, many things that contribute to it. One is the fiscal regime, and it means that the fiscal advantages for owners are much, much greater than they are for renters. And that's one of the principal reasons why we're seeing growing levels of inequality and why under 30s today can expect to grow up poorer than their parents, the first generation to be in that position for 100 years. And the fiscal relationship of land is also important in other ways. This is Glasgow, so many of you will remember this huge fire at the Co-op warehouse building on Morrison Street at the south of the Kingston Bridge 2-3 years ago, 2013. When things like this happen and they're in the public eye, I'm a kind of sad geek, and my first reaction is, who owns this? So I went onto the registers and found out that it was owned by a company called Strabane Developments Limited, based in Belfast. They'd bought it in 2003. This was 2013, 10 years later, it had gone on fire. So I went to the Scottish Assessor's website and I looked up the rateable value. The rateable value for this building, as I recall, was £400,000 or £500,000. Now, because it was an industrial building and it was empty, we have chosen to say you don't need to pay any rates on it. So about £200,000, £250,000 a year is being not even avoided. We just say, I mean, Strabane Developments don't need to pay it. We've zero-rated it. They owned it for 10 years. So that's about £2 or £2.5 million in local taxes that this company wasn't paying, not because it was avoiding tax, because we said they didn't need to Glasgow City Council. And yet when the building goes on fire, they expected Strathclyde Fire and Rescue to come out and put the fire out, and they did. There was 20 appliances there. They expected the police force to maintain civil order. They expected the local authority to manage all the disruption that took place in terms of the road network and public access in the vicinity for, I think, 2-3 months it was inhibited. They expect the civil apparatus of government to be available, principally the courts, to settle any disputes about liability for the fire, who started it, or any damage that's been caused to other people's property, or damage that's been caused to life, etc. In other words, everyone who owns land and property depends on the state to provide essential services, not only emergency services, but the registers and people to look after their property rights, and ultimately an armed force of the Navy, the Air Force and the Army to defend the country against invasion. Because one of the first things an invading army does, and we saw this in Yugoslavia, is go to the land registry and burn it. Because what you want to do is you want to eliminate all records of prior ownership. So how we tax land is very important. Incidentally, after this event, I wrote a Freedom of Information inquiry to Strathclyde Fire and Rescue, who put the fire out very bravely, obviously, and said, how much non-domestic rates do you pay annually? And they came back and they totted it all up. Strathclyde Fire and Rescue was a huge fire and rescue service covering everyone from Campbellton to Paisley. £2.5 million a year they were paying in rates, yet these people weren't paying any. So that leads me on to kind of talking about taxation and how we do things fiscally, because this is fundamentally important, because we do have an economy that's growing more and more unequal, and property and land is a key element of that. The Murrelees Review was written in 2010 by the Institute for Fiscal Studies and Nuffield, I think it was, chaired by Professor James Murrelees, who's a Nobel laureate economist from Cambridge and who is also an advisor on the Scottish Government's Council of Economic Advisers. In their report, which is well worth reading, chapter 16, if you're interested in property, chapter 15 is good on wealth. They say that in the UK, poor tax design contributes to an inefficient housing market, distortionary taxation of financial services, excessive reliance on debt, employment levels lower than they need be, and distorted and inefficient savings and investment decisions. The review sets out a long-term strategy for reform, and in so doing speaks to immediate policy priorities. And they argue for dramatic reform in the way we tax property, for example. And this was highlighted about 20 years ago in the 1980s when the Jubilee Line was built. This is an extension out to Canary Wharf to open up the East End. And this cost the taxpayer £3.5 billion. And there was a property developer called Don Riley who owned a lot of property in and around this area. He was very, very keen to see the railway built because he knew his property would rise in value, he would get tenants, he would become wealthy. And yet he didn't have to lift a finger to do this. And so he decided to go around and do a little study, and he went around and did a little study, and within, I seem to recall, it was 1 kilometre, or maybe 500 metres of each of the new stations along this line, land values had risen by £13.5 billion.
The LSE then did a study and said 9.75 billion, but it's in the right ballpark, about 10 billion. In other words, three times the cost of the railway was a free gratis gift to landowners. And this shows you the kind of impact this has. And of course, then those that leads to higher rents, which have to be paid by companies, which are passed on to customers. It leads to higher housing costs, which have to be paid by people from their wages, etc. We did a little study, a Dublin economist and myself in Northern Ireland, looking at a land value tax, which is a way of recurring of levying a recurrent annual levy on the value of land. So you exclude all the improvements. So you encourage people to build and expand their houses without any penalty. And it was quite interesting because we did this against a backdrop of Northern Ireland, which had the most volatile housing market in Britain, had the biggest boom and crash in Britain, even bigger than the Republic. And they were looking for ways in which they could perhaps stabilise this because Northern Ireland had been plunged into about £30 billion of negative equity. We calculated if house prices had grown only by 2% a year, there'd be £58 billion in the economy that's not there just now. And as I say, because of recourse loans, householders in Northern Ireland are saddled with this debt for 20 years. That is a massive drag on the Northern Ireland economy. So could we do anything about it? We calculated, and the interesting thing about Northern Ireland is they still have domestic rates. So they didn't get poll tax, they didn't get council tax. So they have 798,000 pieces of individual data on the size of homes and their individual values. We asked the Northern Ireland executive if we could get this raw data. It's available on the website, you just type in postcodes and get it. But we said, give me the raw data. And they said, no, they're going to charge us 20,000 or so. So we've got a Dutch student at Trinity College Dublin, who's very good on programming, and he wrote a Python script. Don't know what that is, but anyway, what it does is it just feeds in all the postcodes in Northern Ireland into this computer, and you run it for 6 to 8 hours it ran for, and it will download every single record that it displays. And so we got all the data downloaded, and we had to clean it up because some of it was a bit dirty. And when we launched the report at the end of it, we said to the Director of Land and Property Services, he said, how did you get all this data? And we said, well, we just downloaded it from your website. And by the way, some of it's a bit iffy, and if you'd like to, we could sell you a cleaned-up version of it. But again, it's an illustration of how important information is. You know, everyone should be able to get access to the raw data held by the public about things like the value of property. Anyway, that's the distribution of land values. We took a 100-square-metre home and looked at how much it was worth, how much it cost in different parts of Northern Ireland, and effectively the difference is land value. And that gives you that. And then this would be the impact of shifting the burden of property tax to a land value tax. We did a little bit of work earlier in Scotland and replacing the council tax, showing that everyone up to Band E would get an increase of 0.9%. But this would be quite efficient reallocation of the burden of taxation towards people who own more expensive land and who've done very well out of it because of the regressive nature of the council tax. And again, in the Murley's review, they argue for the introduction of this to replace the non-domestic rating. And say, why is it, if it's so simple, it's almost undeniable, why then do we not have one? Why indeed is the possibility barely part of the mainstream political debate with proponents considered marginal and unconventional? That's people like me. and the answer, of course, is that Britain is wedded to this notion that house prices will forever increase, which is deadly for the economy, it's deadly for future generations. And of course, banks are up to their neck in this because they have all their assets, all that money they made, secured against domestic property, so they'd go underwater if we had a crash. So we're in a very, very difficult place. We're also in a place where, in UK elections, politicians are fighting for a relatively small number of votes in marginal seats. And if you tell them that you want to stabilise house prices and even decline, you're not going to get their vote. And the FT was brave enough 2 weeks ago to do a big piece on this and have a lead editorial saying if Britain wants to become a competitive economy again, it needs to get house prices down and fast because it is a massive drag on the economy. Now, in the past, we had very active debates about this. In the late 19th and early 20th century, Britain's first survey of who owned the country, the owners of lands and heritages, return was done in 1872 on the back of a great debate in Parliament about the fact that very few people own most of the country. Lloyd George and his Chancellor then, the Liberal Churchill, fought to introduce a bill, a finance bill, that would levy land taxes, the famous People's Budget. Blocked by the House of Lords, had to have another election, passed the Parliament Act of 1911 to stop the Lords being able to block finance acts. And then it was introduced. And one of the first things that act did was It meant that the Inland Revenue had to go and survey and identify who owned the whole of Britain and Ireland, because if you're going to levy this, you need to know who you're going to levy it. And so there was an amazing, amazing survey done between 1910 and 14 that surveyed the ownership and occupation and the improved and unimproved value of every single hereditament in the whole of Great Britain and Ireland. Now, these provisions were later repealed by the, I can't remember which government it was, in 1920, but the work had already been done, the Inland Revenue had done its mapping, and these only came into the public domain in the 1990s, but they're fascinating maps, and it shows you what the Edwardians could do with ink and paper that we apparently find it so difficult. But we look across countries like Denmark. Denmark has a very sophisticated land administration system. It has databases of land values per square metre and property values, so it levies levies a range of land taxes. In Britain, we don't even have a proper land use database. In Northern Ireland, I wanted to know how many hectares are occupied for domestic purposes. No one can tell you that. No one can tell you how much land is devoted to domestic property or industrial property or retail property or farms or sporting estates or forests. Well, forests we can tell you, but that's about the only one. And that's crazy. We need a much, much better system of administration. And yet, underneath it all, we have quite sophisticated systems. This is an extract from the Land Registry showing, actually, the Grangemouth Petrochemical Refinery. Not the refinery, the other bit. I can't remember what it is. Now, PetroChina came in here, the Chinese state oil corporation. It bought a 30% stake, and the first thing it wanted was security on its asset. So the government said, yeah, we'll register your land. And that's what they did. So we have, and part of the challenge of the land reform agenda is to get a lot of this information out into the public domain so that communities and individuals can see this information, it's transparent, and all the rest of it. I've been working for 10 years to get a very useful data set out of the government, and they've resisted and resisted. I eventually succeeded last year. It's called the Integrated Administration and Control System, the IACS data set. And it's a digital data set of every single field in the whole of Scotland that claims agricultural subsidies, and the EU need this for auditing purposes. So I've now got, this is just Highland and Aberdeenshire, but I've got the whole of Scotland now. So I'm going to publish it, and the Scottish Government doesn't want me to do that, but I'm going to publish it, and I'm going to crowdsource who owns Scotland, and we're going to get people to click on a field and fill out data, and we're going to aim to do this in a year, launching soon. The other important aspect of all of this is how we do democracy and how we govern land relations. We stand in sharp contrast to most of the rest of the Europe, which has a much more decentralized form of civil administration, French communes and Spanish municipios, etc. We have the most concentrated pattern of private land ownership almost anywhere in the world. We also have the most concentrated pattern of local government. We've only got 32 local authorities. So this is the lowest tier of local government. Community councils don't count because they're not statutory and they have no power. I mean, they were a sop after we abolished local government in 75. A median population of 115,000, almost 1,000 square kilometres, contrasting with countries like France, with 36,000 municipalities. It's a bit mad, really, but more typically, Belgium, which is smaller than Highland Council, with 589 local authorities. And not only that, in a place, and this is just a random example, this is Hemsedal Commune in Norway, population of 2,200, responsible for a huge range of public services. You pay income tax at 28% in Norway. 12.8% of this income tax goes straight to the commune. So at a meeting like this on a Thursday evening to debate, I don't know, a new peer in the football pitch on a Saturday morning at the shops and the school playground, you're meeting on a daily basis the people that two weeks ago I paid my tax to George Osborne. You're meeting the people who you gave considerable sums of money to. And it builds for a much, much higher level of trust and transparency in how public money is spent because the people are there. In a room like this, half the council would be here. Whereas in Britain, we give it all to the Treasury, and then they give some to the Scottish Parliament, and then in a kind of battle of wits, local authorities get a bit, and then we don't really see anything below that level, and there's not much accountability. And this really got highlighted, sorry, I'll finish, to me when I was doing the study in Northern Ireland, and I was looking at other countries in Europe and how they do property tax and stuff. And I discovered in Denmark they have a variety of property taxes, but one of them is a land tax, which is administered by the municipalities. And it was interesting because the SKAT, who were the Danish tax authorities at the time, were running a campaign to get Danes to declare property they owned outside Denmark, because this tax is not payable just on property you own in Denmark, but also property you own outside. So in the Nordic countries, that was all easy because of the exchange information. But, you know, in the south of Spain, Danes have villas and stuff. So there was a campaign to get Danes to declare what property they owned outside. I thought this was interesting because there's about 490,000 acres of land in Scotland owned by Danes. So I contacted SCAT and said, how many people, Danish citizens, pay the land that's called the Grund tax, I think, on property in the United Kingdom, and how much does it yield? I don't actually recall the figures, but it was something in the region of 58 Danish citizens. And I said, that's ridiculous. I mean, there's probably 5,000 in London alone. I said, I've got 490,000 acres of land in Scotland owned by Danes. I said, if you want me to, I can help and we can go on some kind of quid pro quo here, and I take a cut. They weren't very happy with that, and quickly communication stopped. They got a bit suspicious about who I was. But anyway, we've got a gentleman in the top right here who's one of Denmark's most wealthy men, Anders Paulsen. He's now almost Scotland's biggest landowner. He owns about 190,000 acres of land, and he's got another £1 billion to spend. He lives in Esbjerg in a small farm and a relatively modest house, and I'm sure he's paying his taxes. And if he is paying his taxes, he's the only landowner who's not occupying non-domestic or domestic property in the whole of Scotland, other than these other Danes who should also be paying their taxes, who's actually paying some tax on their land in Scotland, but not to Highland Council. He's paying it to his municipality back in Esbjerg, and this is a very nice new kindergarten that Esbjerg Commune built just last year. And that seems kind of mad to me. And of course, big landowners, farmers, agriculture got derated in the 50s. There's no rational reason for that. Why should a hairdresser in a village be paying £5,000 a year, whatever, non-domestic rates, and a millionaire farmer outside paying nothing? Defies belief. So we need to get this straight. And I put it to Scottish ministers a year or so ago that one way of solving the housing crisis would be that no one should have to pay more than £10,000 for a housing plot. And they said, oh, that'd be very difficult. I said, don't worry about implementation. We'll sort out, plenty of us out here who'll work out how we do that. All we want, and it's shorter than a tweet, we just want you to stand up and say it, right? And that would almost at a stroke, not at a stroke, because you've still got finance, you've still got planning and all the rest of it, but it would revolutionise housing. And housing is a human right. We have a human right to be housed. Hasn't been incorporated into British law because British law has only incorporated the European Convention, which only contains a limited number of the rights in the UN Universal Declaration. There's a big, as the Brian mentioning, debate on land now. The Scottish Affairs Committee, which I'm a special advisor to, is completing its inquiries. We've had the Land Reform Review Group last May reported, and we've got a land reform bill coming up to be introduced in June. Which will introduce a land reform commission. It'll bar offshore tax havens from being used to register companies to own land, better land information, powers of intervention, reform in the public sector, action on charities, reintroducing shooting rates for sporting estates that were abolished in the 90s, reforming common good law, agricultural holdings, etc. And there's a whole lots of other stuff, council tax reform. There's an alternative to the council tax commission, which I sit on, which will be announced in the next couple of days. Succession law, inheritance, children have no legal rights to inherit land in Britain, in Scotland. We're going to change that. Trust ports, an old social enterprise, harbour legislation, compulsory purchase. One of the reasons it's very difficult for local authorities to buy land on a compulsory purchase, back in the 50s there was a court ruling that said if you want land to build something on, the landowner's entitled to the new higher value. Post-war Germany had compulsory purchase powers they introduced. They would never have dreamt of doing that because they needed to rebuild a country. So the landowner gets about 1.5 or 1.8%, 1.8 times the existing use value of land. And the local authority or the municipality gains the uplift in value. And in fact, during the war, the Uthwaite Committee, that was set up as part of the Planning Acts, recommended that this increase in value that comes from granting planning consent should, called betterment, should accrue to the public. And that rapidly went away. The Crown Estate's going to get devolved. That's a substantial area of seabed, marine, foreshore, agricultural estate. So we're in a very interesting time where debate around all these topics is beginning to be legitimised. Hasn't before. People have got more confidence about talking about them. There's more information and awareness out there. And we can also talk to each other much more easily than we could 15 years ago when land reform started in the Parliament with the advent of, you know, expanded social media, etc. So I'll stop there.